Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Juan was in the early stages of residential treatment. He loved to see if he could confuse adults in large and small ways. Each situation was another chance to throw adults off balance. During a class I was teaching, he raised his hand when I asked a question. When I called upon him, he smiled and said, "I didn't have my hand up. I was stretching," while holding back a small grin. Later in the class, I asked many other questions, and now Juan wanted to speak. Each time he raised his hand, I said with a smile, "Juan is still stretching, so I'll call on Tim." After this happened 3 times, Juan said in a frustrated tone, "You're just doing this to me on purpose." A couple of minutes later, I came back to Juan and said, "Are you ready to make a deal with me that when your hand is up, you're wanting to be called on?" He said, "Okay," and eagerly participated in the rest of the class. This was a very small matter, but the message was clear to Juan. The next day, he told his roommate, "Don't lie to Dave. It never works." This story is from a book by Dr. Dave Ziegler, Achieving Success with Impossible Children, How to Win the Battle of Wills. From a parent's perspective, how can we help impossible kids to behave? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today is truly an expert at working with impossible kids. Dr. Dave Ziegler is a psychologist and foster parent to hundreds of disturbed children. He works especially with children with attachment and trauma disorders. He is executive director of SCAR Jasper Mountain, an agency near Eugene, Oregon, that treats society's most damaged children and families, working for 30 years as a therapist, clinical supervisor, trainer, frequent expert witness, and consultant to programs across the U.S. and in Canada. His treatment program is nationally recognized for its innovation and success with the most difficult cases. Dr. Ziegler's most recent book is Achieving Success with Impossible Children, How to Win the Battle of Wills. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All kids at one time or another can seem impossible to their parents, to their teachers. What do you mean when you use the term impossible children?
That's a very good way to put it, because actually it isn't the child that's impossible. It's the situation that's impossible. We have found that most every child that other people have given up on, that say that they're a lost cause, that nothing works with this child, if you change the situation and you have the ingredients that really makes it work, the child becomes very workable. So there are impossible children all over, but that has more to do with our environments to be able to assist them than it does say something about the child. And so we have a world for the most difficult children. And I'm here to say, after 23 years of working on this, it is working. So the most impossible children are still workable.
This presupposes that children are sort of plastic and that they can respond to different circumstances. Does that make them very different than adults?
I would use the word malleable. Actually, the brain changes. And the good news and bad news is that every time a bad thing happens, the brain of a child codes that and remembers that, not only in memory, but the physical structure of the brain changes a little bit with each negative experience. Now we find with brain research that the same thing happens with positive things. So every time you do something special for a child, every time they're excited and something good happens, every time somebody meets their needs in a great way, their brain changes a little bit. So malleable is exactly right. Mm-hmm. Now adults, their brain continues to adapt and change, but it slows down a little bit. But the younger the child, the more that process works.
Children aren't usually born impossible. So how do they become impossible?
Well, the issue with kids that have a lot of struggles and have very poor behavior or affective dysregulation, or another way of saying that, a lot of emotional outbursts, emotional disturbances, those things almost always happen because something in their world has been beyond their ability to cope with it. Kids want to succeed. Kids want to fit in. Kids want to attach and bond. And what happens with the kids that I work with and the kids who become very, very challenging is very bad things have happened to them. And they learn the wrong message about adults. They learn the wrong message about the world. And they create inside of them what we call an inner working model, that they believe that the world is going to be a certain way. And based upon actually the, maybe the first month of their life, that establishes an inner working model through which, when they're 60 years old, they're still functioning from part of that model that was encoded in their brain very early. So you can see our challenge is to get to these kids very early and help them out.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about one historic phenomenon, and I know there are others like this, the children who were in the Kinder transports who were taken out of their homes in Germany and taken, I think, mostly to England during World War II.
And some were taken to Australia, yes.
Okay, and they could have come from very loving, fine surroundings, and then they got put into a situation in some circumstances we've heard about where it wasn't so loving and fine, and they were able to manage.
Right.
Was that because the imprint from earlier didn't override the imprint from
You're
later?
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. You will find that the kids that did better were the kids that had a more positive, more solid experience earlier in their life where their needs were met, and their brain, which the brain's job is to help the organism and the child survive. And so things work well. The brain says, hey, you know, we're going to be okay. Things are changing, but we can adapt to this. But the kids that had problems with that, that's why we know that neglect is the most serious long-term impact mm-hmm. on children, because of that stamp that goes on their brain. Throughout their life, they say, our needs are not going to be met. And when they are, they say, well, this was a fluke. The next time, they won't. Okay, but the issue that you're talking about, when kids get transplanted into a new environment, that could be adoptive homes or foster homes or families that divorce, et cetera, if they go into that situation with an early inner working model that's positive and they get the support they need, it can work.
Well, let's talk about bonding a little bit. Bonding, okay. Of course, is important in a child's development. Would you talk about how kids bond?
Right. Well, let's put it this way. We forget that human beings are animals, and animals have instincts. So the first process that happens, and this is at birth, is the child has an instinct that the brain says, you must do a number of things to survive, because human beings are the most helpless animal on the planet at birth. And so the things they have to do, they have to seek proximity with a care provider to get warmth, to get food, to get safety, and so they are wired to connect with their mother. Now, mothers are animals too, and mothers have a response, which you two know, and I know, that every time you spend time with a little child, you want to do certain things. You want to cuddle with them, you want to care for them, you want to hold them carefully, and we have instincts to respond to the noises they make and all the different images that these young children do. So it starts with instinct, okay? Then it goes to the pleasure principle, where the brain says, you approach pleasure and you avoid pain. And so they scream when they're uncomfortable, and they make goo and little noises when they're very comfortable, and they smile, and that elicits a response in the mother. So we start with instinct, we go to the pleasure principle, and then we move to something called attachment over time. The child really connects with that mother. A child at 1 month can pick out their mother's face in 10,000 faces. And so we begin that process. The child doesn't initially know that they're different than their mother. They feel like they're the same organism. And then they begin to understand that somehow they're different, but they're still connected in a very special way. That turns into an emotional connection. That turns into a physical connection. That turns into what I call a spiritual connection, deeply connected inside. And so John Bowlby and attachment theory, we have known for 50 years how this process works, and now we're finding more and more through brain research that he was absolutely right in 1949 with some of his thoughts about how we connect and bond.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on impossible children.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Dave Ziegler about impossible children. We hear about children through neglect or whatever in different settings who are unable to make that bond. How do parents create one when the child seems unable to do it?
I would say that a little differently. I know that that's what people say, and that's what we call an attachment disorder, the inability to bond. Actually, what an attachment disorder is a very healthy adaptation to a situation where the child found out that the care provider was actually dangerous. They actually got in the way of their ability to survive. And so their inner working model, if you remember that term, begins to push away that primary care provider and says, big people are a problem. And then that instinctive process that I just described a minute ago, it goes into reverse. And it says, okay, your survival depends upon staying away and not connecting with the adult. Now, that may happen in the first 6 months of life. The child doesn't remember that. They didn't make those conscious choices. Their brain did. Now, later on down the road, when they are in a loving family, they still have that same inner working model. Then we begin the process of working on reestablishing that attachment. Maybe it never existed in the first place, but we have found very specific tools and steps that we can go about establishing a connection with kids, even with a severe attachment disorder. We've found success there.
What kinds of things
do you have to do? Let's put it this way. It's not fancy therapy that you're going to get with somebody like me with lots of initials after their name. It's actually a home that responds and changes the brain. Remember, the brain is adaptable. And so every positive experience, the brain begins to change. So here are the four steps that we take. The situation has to be safe and the child experience safety. Second is their basic needs must be met unconditionally. You don't tell a child, although my mother did this, you know, she apologizes. You know, if you talk back, you go to bed without dinner. With these kind of kids, you don't want to have their basic needs in any way conditional because their brain says, red alert, smoke alarm goes off, right? That kind of thing. And so the third is that the environment issues constant invitations to be closer, to be closer, to be closer. By the way, one of the most difficult steps to do with these kids because they're very difficult to be around. They'll hurt you, they'll spit on you, they'll call you names, et cetera, et cetera. They're really severe kids. The fourth one is very important. You develop a reciprocal world where you say, you must do something in order to get the things that you want, not what you need, but what you want. And these kids want lots of things. They want the latest Game Boy. They want the latest toy. They want the latest book. They want to go down to the water park. And so for them to get something, you teach them to give something back. Well, you work with me in the flower garden, and then we go to the water park in the afternoon. Well, I don't like it. Well, then you don't want to go to the water park. Okay, I'll work with you. And you begin to teach them reciprocity. Okay? Mm-hmm. With those four steps, over a period of time, the brain changes. Every time that happens, the brain says, adults can be trusted. My needs are going to be met. This is good. I like this world better than the one that I push people away. And we change their brains, and we change their thinking, we change their emotions, and we change their behavior. Some of the most difficult kids have been successful.
Now, how do you tell parents to do number three? This is the environment issues, constant invitations of being part of it.
Some of the kids I'll be talking about today are kind of severe, and other kids aren't quite this bad. But I work with kids that defecate in their pants so that they smell bad, so that other kids don't want to be around them. They make themselves unattractive. They do sexual things, so people don't want to be around them. I just don't want to be, you know, and they feel better when no one's around them. And we have to break through that even when something inside of us may feel kind of disgusted. We have to take the step toward them and say, I want to be closer to you. I want to know who you are. I want to spend time with you. Otherwise, they're controlling you and they don't get closer to people. So that third step is really critical. How do we do that? We need to know what we need to do. We need to know what the child is doing, and to give that child a chance. We have to break through, and we have to win that battle of wills.
Now, you brought up the word control.
Yes.
About kids being controlling.
Yes.
How is control significant in our changing their behavior?
Control is very important, but please understand how I mean that. Control is not about controlling the child. Control is all about controlling yourself and your feelings and your responses to the child. And these kids, well, they would walk in this door right now and within 10 minutes would tell, some of the more severe kids, would tell what your buttons are and how to get you irritated. And they, within minutes, they could find something to make you mad at them. And as soon as that happens, they have controlled you because that's a world that they're comfortable with. And we have to break through that and control our reactions and our feelings. And we have to control our behavior. And then we have to control the environment and the energy in the household. The kids that people say, oh, you have to walk on eggshells because she gets up in the morning and she is just hell on wheels. You know, it's just horrible to be around her. Well, we need to make sure that the kids don't set the tone in the household. All these things are much easier to say than to do. Mm-hmm. That's why families need coaches to help them. They don't so much need therapy. What they need is a good coach to teach them how to do a better job at the things that they're doing well with parenting and how to understand these kids, because the key is if you understand the child, you have a better sense of understanding the problem and understanding the solution. And that's what my books are all about, is how to do that, how to be the detective to figure these things out.
It sounds like anger has a very big component here.
Well, see, anger is one way that the kids push people away. That's how they control you. If I started getting angry right now, you would start getting a little tense. And the children learn that. By the way, they also learn that using foul language makes people tense. And they also learn that when they do sexual things, people get real jittery. But they're not necessarily because they just have an anger problem or a sexual problem. It's because they want to control people, and that's what they've learned to use as a tool.
Dr. Ziegler, what's the most important thing for parents to remember when dealing with impossible children?
I think we absolutely need to take the first step, which is to understand where the child is coming from. I have an important concept that I call speaking in opposites. Judges ask me a lot, or attorneys before judges, they say, do children tell the truth? And I say, yes, they just about always tell the truth. Well, Dr. Ziegler, what about this child that lied about this and that? I said, not with words. They tell the truth by their energy. You need to learn how to understand their message. And often you can ignore their words. I mean, it's a little bit like teenagers, okay? When a teenager says, I don't want structure. I don't want to tell you where I'm going. How come I have to tell you when I'm going to be home, who I'm going to be with, if so-and-so's parents are going to be home? That makes me angry. I want you to know, as a therapist, that teenager will come to me and say, I am so lucky to have a parent that cares where I am. But they're not going to say that to you. So what you can often do with teenagers is say the opposite of what they're saying, and it's closer to the truth. I want structure. I want you to know who's in my life. I want you to know if the parents are there. I feel safer when I know that you care about that. But they won't tell you that. It's the same with these young kids with emotional disturbances. And we learn to, what I call, translate their behavior, translate their energy, ignore their words, okay, and begin to understand what's going on inside of their world. Because unless you can, you don't know what the problem is you're dealing with. The symptom may be stealing. The symptom may be lying. And I might address that problem by not even talking about stealing and lying. I might address that problem by making sure that dad spends 5 minutes after he gets home from work before dinner throwing a ball in the backyard. And all of a sudden the lying starts decreasing. And so if you can find out what the need is, meet the need, the behavior begins to drop away.
How can parents assess what the needs are?
Sometimes parents get so close to the problem that they can't see the forest for the
yes.
trees. And that's an important element, I think. Particularly, the more challenging the child, the more you need to do that. And the way you do that, I think, is you get somebody on the outside and give you some perspective, some reality check. And I want to say that, again, doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. It doesn't have to be a professional. It can be a wise grandmother. It can be your best friend. Who you can help her with her kids because you can see the issues. You have some distance, and she can help you with yours. You know, I asked the question, how did we raise kids before Sigmund Freud came along, right? We've only had therapists for the last 100 and some years, right? Before that, it was the wise people in the village that helped us raise kids better, and we can still do that, and that helps. Some of the techniques I talk about in my first book, Raising Children That Refuse to Be Raised, and in the most recent one, Achieving Success, there's some step-by-step things with some of these problems, but one of those suggestions is get help, because raising a child is a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do the best job we can, we need a good coach, and we need good team players, the teacher, the big brother, big sister, the caseworker, you know, the aunt and uncle, grandma, all of us working together on this, because sometimes it's overwhelming to any one person.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on impossible children.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Dave Ziegler about impossible children. You mentioned earlier adopted and foster children.
Yes.
Are there special techniques that families need to learn in working with those children when they have what we call impossible actions or behaviors?
All kids that have been removed from their family have attachment issues. And sometimes we confuse how serious the problem is. But if your family has been disrupted, you either have attachment issues, or you might have an attachment problem, or it may develop into an attachment disorder. But there are all different levels of that. I think adoptive families particularly need to understand what that child's needs are. You know, we have a lot of issues with or suggestions to own the child. I think families need to adjust to the children as much as they expect the child to adjust to them. I do a lot of work with adoption. And actually, I have a model called the adoption courtship model for the older kids, where they get to know each other. They date for a while. All of their contact is outside of the family home without the family's rules and the family being on their turf. And they go to the beach. They do all sorts of things. And then the child decides, I want to commit to you. And the family says, well, we want to commit to you. And we have three levels of commitment: commitment to time, commitment to relationship, commitment to life. And we go through this process. And our adoptions with some of these very difficult kids have worked, where the regular adoptive committees put the child in the home and let's go for it, sign the papers and give them the support they need, and then they have all sorts of trouble.
So we're addressing totally different kinds of issues.
Yep.
And we're talking about adoption, not adoption of a newborn child or
no.
a little baby, but indeed.
Adoption of challenging kids. And, you know, there are a lot of kids that are out there that have special needs that, you know, that they need those adoptive parents. And that's the biggest challenge, I think, in our country, is to find families for those kids with special needs. Because what will happen to those kids if they don't find a family to really support them as they grow up? They don't develop a resiliency. They begin to think they're on their own. And unfortunately, they're some of the casualties of our society: drug and alcohol use, underemployment or unemployment, the welfare system, failed marriages, and just a whole process of failure.
Dr. Ziegler, is there a story that you could tell us about a particular child and your experience with that child?
One of our very challenging little girls, we'll call her Mary. Mary would get up every morning and she would say, you know, I don't like you and I don't like this place and I don't like anything in life. And she would do this every morning. It was kind of a ritual. She went through our residential program. When she left, I didn't feel like we had made any contact with her. She was one of the few children that I didn't feel ever changed. She never changed her affect. She never said goodbye. She never said thanks. She never said any of this. I worked, got her into an adoptive home. Every morning she got up, came to the breakfast table and said, I just want you all to know that I hate your family and I hate being here. And the family got a hold of me. I said, hang in there, hang in there. You know, we'll get through this. After 6 months, the family said, we can't take it another day. And I said, I understand. And the adoption disrupted. She went into group care. And I thought, she's always been one of the five kids, out of the hundreds I've worked with, one of the five kids that I didn't feel like I ever made a difference with. Until last August, true story, I get a call. The receptionist says, it's Mary on the phone. And she's had a distinctive name, so I remembered her, and I thought, oh, what is she going to tell me? She's going to be angry at me. And I get on the phone, and she said, I just want you to know that I wanted to call and say thank you. And she said, I've been in a relationship for 7 years, and I have a beautiful baby, and I was looking at my baby yesterday, and I said, what is my job for you? And she said, it came to me, I need to do for you what Dave did for me, and I had to call you and tell you that. That's one of the kids that I didn't make an impact with. So I believe that what we do is plant seeds. They sprout, and the fruit is something that someone else may enjoy. I may not enjoy it, but it's important to plant the seed.
Dr. Ziegler, is there a particular message you'd like to get across through talking with us today?
Yes, there are many, many challenges that we have, and I want you to know that I work with the most challenging kids, so I am just not talking about kids that have been easy. I have kids from other states come to my program, and I work with the hardest kids. And my message today is if we can learn to understand these kids, if we can begin to meet their needs and give them the conditions they need, their brain will help them mold into the kind of person that will have a chance in society. So my message is one of hope. All of the brain research is a very hopeful message to me, but we've got to get going. We've got to begin to understand these little guys. And the younger, the better, so that we can have many more productive citizens and many fewer casualties in the future. Mm-hmm. You know that child abuse is passed on from generation to generation. We need to stop that cycle, and we need to stop it now. And we now know techniques that will get us there.
Unfortunately, we have to close. There's obviously so much more to say. But before we close, Dr. Ziegler, in addition to your book, Achieving Success with Impossible Children, How to Win the Battle of Wills, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue this subject further?
I mentioned earlier my first book, Raising Children That Refuse to Be Raised. My second one is Traumatic Experience in the Brain. The second one is, with all of the brain research that's been done, so what does a parent do differently? And it answers the question, so what? So now that we know this, so what? And then the most recent book. I will just suggest right now those three books, it's enough for people to kind of hear. Go to those books, and they refer you to many more books. And there's a bibliography in each one.
Is there a website for Jasper Mountain?
The website, my program that talks about what we do and how we do it, and you can get the publications through that, is SCAR-Jasper, J-A-S-P-E-R, abbreviation for Mountain, MTN.org.
Well, Dr. Dave Ziegler, you have been a wonderful resource just being yourself for all of our listeners, and we've so enjoyed having you on the program. So thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Ziegler's latest book, Achieving Success with Impossible Children, How to Win the Battle of Wills. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That will be very helpful to us. Mention show number 261 and tell us what station you're listening to if you can. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. We'd like to remind you about some important toll-free numbers we sometimes share with our listeners. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. And the National Runaway Switchboard, 1-800-621-4000. 1-800-621-4000. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.